Watching an actress get her hair chopped off on screen has never, ever, ever been this effective. This is The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Welcome to Seen and Heard. It's the podcast where Jackie and I go through the Sight and Sound Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time list. Hey, this week we're doing number 9 on the list. This is Carl Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. Ooh. From 1928.
Yep.
So this is our fourth silent film in a row.
This is the end of the streak,
this
I think.
This is the end of the run. So after this, we're going, but I believe next week is...
Seventh Seal.
We're getting into our first Bergman of the list.
Yes, so I can't wait.
This is the end of our silent run.
It's been fun, but I think I'm ready to move
on. I'm ready too. There are more silent films on the list, I believe, but this is it for this run.
Good.
And this will be our fifth that we've covered so far.
How did that happen?
Yeah, it just happened because of the nature where we go back and forth from top and bottom.
You mean how we ping pong?
How we ping pong.
So, yeah. I mean, it's been fun, but I'm ready to move on.
Yeah, I'm ready for some Bergman.
I'm so excited.
I want to do David Lynch. I want to do Blue Velvet so bad.
Gonna have to wait.
Blue Velvet is like in the middle.
Long ass time.
Yeah. God.
Hey, you're the one who wanted to ping pong.
I don't know. I feel like that was a Jackie recommendation, which was a great recommendation.
You gotta mix it up.
I agree. And I've gotten a couple comments from people saying that they like the ping pong.
Is good?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So what have you been watching this last week, Jackie?
I watched The Celebration after you suggested it.
Oh, did you?
I did, and I loved it. It's such a unexpected ride. That's the best way you can describe that movie, right?
I think so.
And it's so interesting because the whole Dogma thing, like you hear about Dogma, but then I've seen Breaking the Waves. That's not a Dogma movie.
Mm-mm.
I've seen Dancer in the Dark, not a Dogma movie. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been kind of, I've never seen a Dogma movie, but I've heard so much about it. And I've seen those like two early von Trier movies and they weren't Dogma. So I was just like, does this really exist? Or were they just talking about this? Did they actually do this? So seeing it, and this is like the ultimate one, right? Like this was the first one.
This was number one, yeah.
Now I get it, you know? And it's great, and I think it's hopeful. Like, I think the movie itself, it is so dark, but I think it's also hopeful, and I think the fact that it works so well is just, in and of itself, hopeful.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was also my first Dogma movie.
Yeah.
I think Lars only did one or two, like, proper Dogma movies.
Yeah, one of them is called The Idiots.
Yep, that's the one I know, which I haven't seen.
No, and it's like, okay...
He was around, he was making movies in the 80s, which is funny.
Oh,
like,
really?
By the time Dogma happened, he was already like an established director. Like, he was already kind of a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Vinterberg did get his start. I think this was Vinterberg. No, Vinterberg had made a couple small movies before The Celebration, but this was like his big breakthrough.
Show me the Dogma. That's all I want to see.
Yeah.
But the big movie for me this week was Michael Haneke's Amour.
You know what? I have not
Greg?
Seen it.
It is. All I can say is that I had a hard time falling asleep the night that I watched it. And I woke up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and I was actually scared to go to the bathroom.
Scared?
Scared. Because this movie kills you. But it doesn't kill you with violence. Mm-hmm. Doesn't kill you with guns. Doesn't kill you with what you think a horror movie is. It literally kills you with love. It's a marvel of a movie. I can't praise it enough. I think that it is, I don't want to watch it for a good 15 years, but I think I'm going to be thinking about it almost every day until that day comes because it is vicious, but also like you're kind of at peace at the end. Wow. It's scary. Like I had to cover my eyes at one point. And yes, it is about an old man taking care of his wife who just had a stroke.
Yeah.
And it is that scary because it's that.
I believe it. It's Michael Haneke.
Yeah. You have to see it.
Yeah.
It's That's all I can say.
Have you seen anything else by him? Or was this like an intro?
No, this is my first movie of his. Mm-hmm. And it won best foreign film at the Oscars. And the Criterion had this whole section of foreign film Oscar winners. So I watched it.
I think it also won the Palme d'Or.
Fucking deserves it. Because it is.
I could be wrong.
It's something else. It's indescribably strange.
I need to see it.
I can't say anything else about it.
That's one where, like, I'm embarrassed that I haven't seen it. And I've seen, like, 3 or 4 of his other movies. And they're all, yeah.
Just be prepared.
Take a toll on you.
Be prepared.
We did one of his for the film club. I know I brought that up a couple weeks ago. And it was like everyone who joined that week was like sort of shell-shocked.
Be prepared.
Yeah.
It opens with like a, I literally jumped. Like, that's how it opens. And then there's a straight up like nightmare in the middle of it that I had to cover my eyes.
Wow.
And then like, they're just, the way that he shoots them at some point, it's like they look so, it's shot. I don't know how it was shot, but they look like they're literally in front of you and you see every wrinkle on their face and they're just like there and it's overwhelming.
Is it like Dave at the end of 2001?
Yeah.
That's the image I just got.
It's beautiful and scary and sad.
I'm glad that this this movie riled you up.
Yeah. I haven't been riled up like that in a long time.
But what was the last movie to do that?
On Colonel Blimp, maybe.
No, riled up in the way that like
scared?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know, honestly.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you might need more of that in your life.
No, I don't know if I can handle it, honestly.
I love the thought of you getting up in the middle of the night and being
scared to go to the bathroom after watching a love story about old people.
Oh, boy.
It's traumatic.
It's funny because in my head, I was like, oh, that's like the PG Hanukkah movie, or that's like the mainstream one. But everyone that I've heard has told me otherwise. Like, no, it's like just as intense as his other movies. So, yeah. You should see The Piano Teacher with
Isabel
Huppert.
I know, that's next on my list.
Report back.
I will. I literally told my sister after I saw it, like, I just, like, had to tell someone about it. I'm like, this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. And she's like, why would you tell me that? She got so mad at me. Like, she got really, not that she's going to watch the movie, just that I brought that sadness into her life.
I do the same thing, too. When I see a really fucked up movie, I have to tell, like, if I watch it alone, which most of the time it is, I have to tell someone.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's Molly, sometimes it's, like, a friend. I'm like, listen, this is what happens in the movie. I'm like, do you care if I tell you? They're like, no, go ahead.
Yeah.
This fucked up thing happens, then this. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fucked up, but it's also very, that's why I'm so confused. It's fucked up, but it's also very beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like,
he's a master filmmaker. He's on another level. Yeah.
What have you been watching?
Right. God, how do I follow
Lighten
that?
My mood, please.
Yeah. So I had a little bit of a King Who marathon this week because for the film club, we did a movie called Touch of Zen, which is a sort of touchstone wuxia movie from the early 70s. And so I watched King Hu's two movies leading up to Touch of Zen. I saw Come Drink With Me and I saw Dragon Inn. And then I watched Touch of Zen. So I saw 3 martial arts wuxia movies this week, which was a good time. I also saw Seconds for the first time, the John Frankenheimer movie with Rock Hudson. Oh my God. Like you always hear people talk about this movie like in hushed tones, like, oh my God, Seconds. And it's like, wait, I know I gotta see that. Like, what's the deal? I know that Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys infamously saw it in theaters when it came out, or walked into a theater that was playing it and he was like tripping out and he had this like terrible trip and the movie like broke him like psychologically. this is the movie. It's great. It's kind of it's a really dark sci-fi movie with Rock Hudson from the mid 60s by the guy, John Frankenheimer, who did The Manchurian Candidate with the original one with Angela Lansbury and Frank Sinatra. Yeah, this was a really good bleak movie. And of course, everyone was right. I'm late to the party on this one, but everyone was right. It's an amazing movie. Devastating, beautiful. Must see. Beautiful cinematography by the famed DP James Wong Howe. Beautiful movie. Not beautiful, but great. And then I saw I did see Everything Everywhere All at Once,
mm-hmm.
the new movie by the Daniels, which everyone is flipping out about right now. Everyone is on cloud nine with this movie. I don't know if it was that going into it, like the sort of reputation that it got very quickly. I didn't love it. I also didn't really like their last movie, Swiss Army Man. I know I'm like in the minority here. I almost teared up in this movie seeing Kihei Kwan's return to movie screens because I grew up watching Kihei Kwan.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's been gone this whole time, he's been working behind the scenes, you know, as like a trainer and stuff and stunt choreographer. And finally he's back. Like he decided he wanted to get back. He saw Crazy Rich Asians because the whole thing, he dropped off after the Goonies because he was like, oh, there's no interesting roles for Asian yeah. people, which is true. It was like 16 Candles. Mm-hmm. It was shit like that. Mm-hmm. It was like offensive shit.
Yeah.
And so Crazy Rich Asians came out and he saw it and he was like so inspired and he got an agent. And then 2 weeks later, he got the call for this movie.
That's so cool.
Shout out to my friend Janus, who had a significant role behind the scenes of this movie. But yeah, he was so good. And I almost started crying because he's so good in it.
Aww.
And not only is he like a great actor and like really natural and funny and stuff, but he's a trained martial artist. Like he has the first fight scene he's in is really amazing. And of course, Michelle Yeoh, they're both so great in it. They're the best parts of the movie. Not to get like too deep into the weeds, because I know it's just getting a wide release now, but yeah, didn't really do it for me. I appreciate the ambition. I love the cast and I love, again, seeing the two of them together. But yeah, it just didn't really do it for me. It's kind of a Matrix by way of Charlie Kaufman and like Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the, you know, it's like 2.5 hours. I thought it was too long. And yeah, I feel like I might get crucified for this because everyone on my letterbox is like, this is my favorite movie of all time. It didn't do it for me, guys. I'm here to report. Count
That's okay.
me in the Emperor's New Clothes situation here. Yeah, again, I didn't hate it, but, you know. But are you going to see it?
Yeah, of course. I want to see it.
I look forward to your take on the movie.
I do as well. Yeah. Hopefully, maybe I can see it this weekend.
See it this weekend.
We'll see. It's been a long 2 days. I have watched 2 Joan of Arcs in the past 2 days.
Oh my God.
I watched the Bresson version today. And of course, I watched this week's movie, Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc, which we're about to get into right now.
Right now. Let's do it.
The Passion of Joan of Arc first premiered in 1928. It is a silent retelling of the trial of Joan of Arc based on the actual court record of her 1431 trial. It is directed by Carl Theodor Dreyer, co-written by Dreyer and Joseph Delte. The film stars Rene Falconetti in the titular role. Taking place after her capture during the Hundred Years' War, Joan faces an inquisition of French Burgundy clergymen surrounded by their English allies. Throughout her trial, the clergyman tried to get Joan to admit that she was not sent by God, that she has not heard his voice, and instead is being guided by the devil. They try to deceive her by forging a letter from her King Charles VII, then try to blackmail her into signing a formal confession by withholding communion from her. And eventually, when faced with the threat of being burned alive, she gives in and is sentenced to life imprisonment. Shortly after, she withdraws her confession, realizing that she'd rather die than betray God. As she is executed, a riot breaks out against the troops and the clergy by the distraught witnesses who call her a saint. The film also stars Eugene Sylvain, Maurice Schütz, and Anton Artaud as various clergymen and bishops. The big one is Eugene Sylvain. He's like the main one. The film has a pretty crazy history. So Dreyer was Danish and he was invited to make a film in France. And he was basically told to choose between three famous French women, Catherine Medici, Marie Antoinette, or Joan of Arc. And apparently, rumor has it that the final decision came down to pulling straws.
Yeah.
So that's where this movie came from. And yeah, it opened in Copenhagen in 1928 in May. And then it was supposed to premiere in France shortly after, but these French nationalists got really mad that this Danish director was making a movie about Joan of Arc and he wasn't Catholic. So they delayed it. And then it went through some censorship with the Archbishop of Paris. So the film eventually opened in Paris in December. But shortly after, a fire broke out at the lab in Berlin where the film's original negative was. Dreyer was devastated, but he was able to patch together a second negative using different takes that looked pretty similar to his original vision. Apparently, he took a lot of takes. And that was also lost in fire, that second negative. There was also another version created by some found print of that second negative by Joseph Marie Loduca. Have you heard of that one?
No.
So he like patched it together. He's a historian. I think he was also one of the founders of Cahiers du Cinéma.
Oh.
He like patched together. He found some print of the second negative, but he edited it a lot. And instead of inner titles, he put subtitles and Dreyer hated it. In fact, he wrote this letter to the studio, Dreyer. He wrote, "The editor, again, with the best intentions, has tried to make the film more accessible to the general public by appealing to the public's bad taste." That's what he said about that version. But then a miracle happened, and this is the end of my story, I promise. A film miracle happened in 1981. A janitor was cleaning out a closet in a mental institution outside of Oslo and found an original negative from 1928, like Dreyer's original vision.
Wow.
And it's now affectionately known as the Oslo negative.
Huh.
You didn't know that?
I did not know that.
So that's how we have the film now. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had it.
Wow.
It would have been that weird chopped up version. Yeah.
Or, yeah, it's like weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I went into the weird, do you know like the frame rate story behind this movie?
I didn't look into it because I had a feeling that you would.
There's
some confusion about what the frame rate is, right?
Yeah. So on the Criterion disc, at least that I have, there's two ways to watch it. You can watch it in 24 frames per second, which is the standard movie frame rate, or you can watch it in 20. And this was my second time seeing this movie, so I watched it both times in 24 frames a second. And I think it looks better in 24, but Criterion has this whole like 13-minute feature on the frame rate confusion behind this movie because silent movie cameras were hand-cranked.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you couldn't get a perfectly steady frame rate because it's a human hand.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what happened was a lot of silent films, it just varied. Like some silent films would be projected at 16 frames per second. Some would go up to like 28 frames per second, which really alters the runtime of the movie.
Of course.
And if you watch this movie in like even the 20 frames per second, I think it's like 15 minutes longer.
Really?
Yeah, because every scene is just like that much slower.
Yeah.
And it looks weird. They have side-by-side comparisons. I feel like the 20 looks weird. But there's this whole thing of like, they don't know which one Dreyer intended. Like they pulled up this Danish projector's handbook from the era that said project in 16 to 20, but then the score or the original score or something said something differently.
Yeah.
And so like, they don't know. So Criterion offers both. I watched the 24. I think it looks better.
Yeah. I mean,
they said some people think it looks a little cartoony, like a silent film comedy ish because people move a little quickly, but I think it just looks more natural.
Yeah. I think so too. Yeah. And yeah, speaking of the score. So
yeah,
basically
which version did you watch?
I watched the Voices of Light
one. Okay. Yeah,
because here's what happened. Basically, there's no proof that there's a definitive score for this movie.
Yeah.
At those two premieres, it was two different scores. There was like an orchestra and singers, but apparently they weren't that good. And yeah, there's no evidence that Dreyer himself said like, okay, this is the score for this movie. So the version I watched, and it seems like you did too, it's this oratorio called Voices of Light by a musician called Richard Einhorn.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a composer. And basically it's vocal pieces. I watched his little thing on Criterion. He has this little interview that he gave talking about how he scored the movie and what he did. And what he did is he wanted it to be voices because Joan heard voices. And the text of what they're actually saying is taken from writings of medieval female mystics from her time and earlier.
That's cool.
So cool.
That's cool. Yeah.
And yeah, she was obsessed with bells. So what he did is he literally went to the church that she used to pray at, recorded the bells. Every bell you hear in this movie with this score are the bells from Joan of Arc's church.
I didn't know that.
Isn't that so cool?
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Did you like the score?
You know, I think it's very majestic. Here's what I'll say, and this is one of my initial thoughts. When you start the movie on Criterion, the music starts immediately.
Before the Criterion logo,
the Janus Films logo. This is what you hear. This is the first thing. So chills. I mean, like, that was really cool. But then I think I mostly like the score. I'll say that. I'll say I mostly like the score. I feel like sometimes it makes things a little melodramatic.
Yes.
But I mostly like it.
I agree. I mostly like it too. The first time I saw this movie, I watched it with a different score. So there are a couple scores over the years. So this Voices of Light one has kind of been known. This is since it was done in the mid 90s. This is kind of considered the definitive score since then, even though it has no basis, obviously, on the original intention. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty good. The first time I saw the movie, I started watching with Voices of Light, and then 5 minutes in, I switched. I started the movie over, and I put on the Adrian Utley and Will Gregory score from 2010. Adrian Utley is from Portishead, and Will Gregory is from Goldfrapp. But it is this kind of droning rock thing, but it worked really well. And I thought that was my first experience with this movie, was watching it with that score, and it really worked for me. This time I did force myself. I was about to put on that score, and then I heard your voice in my head being like, Greg, you gotta watch the Voices of Light one. I was like, all right, I'm gonna do it. I like the Voices of Light, but I do think it's a little melodramatic, and it's a little, I feel like the tone isn't always right. Like sometimes things are really bleak on screen and the score is like a little light, or it's like there's sort of a disconnect sometimes, which can work.
I agree.
But I don't know that it did in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. One more thing he pointed out that I just want to mention is at the end when she's dying, spoiler alert, and she cries out Jesus, the voices in that part respond with Joan, like a very soft, and I didn't catch it until I heard him say it, because they're just like, you know, but they're saying Joan, and I thought that was really cool.
That's cool.
I like that he took the text from those old writings. I think that's really neat. But yeah, I agree with you. I feel like sometimes it is a little over dramatic, or the tone doesn't really work too well. But
yeah, it's
overall
kind of thing,
I think it's good.
It sounds like he had great intentions and he did his homework in terms of like using the bells and like incorporating that stuff, but that doesn't necessarily make a great score. And as with a lot of silent, I mean, this is one of the most iconic silent films ever made. There's a ton of scores for this. In fact, Nick Cave did one. Cat Power did one. Mm-hmm. Like a bunch of really high profile people have scored Passion of Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not even saying that the one that I listened to was like the definitive one, but I think it worked more than Voices of Light.
See, I wouldn't want to watch this with like rock.
You know what? But
I wouldn't. I know me. I wouldn't.
Yeah, but it's like really well done. And it really puts you into the torture chamber sequence with the Voices of Light. There's like, it's not menacing at all. Mm-hmm. With that other score, it becomes a whole nother thing.
Okay.
It's not like heavy metal or something.
Yeah.
It's like, it's still tastefully done. Like they're accomplished musicians. They're not just like street urchins.
Why am I imagining like Bohemian Rhapsody?
No. There's no singing.
I know, but that kind of...
It's all
of
instrumental.
Kind of like,
okay. No, it's nothing like Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah.
What are your initial thoughts? So we kind of already got into that, but...
We did a little. I first saw this 4 years ago. And of course, it was a movie...
How do you know that? How do you remember that?
You know
that
why?
It exactly
it's
four
because
years ago.
I was on Letterboxd today and I had logged it in 2018.
You've had Letterboxd that long?
Yes, yeah, it's 2017. A lot of people have been on it.
You're
since
a trailblazer.
Like, no.
Yeah, you are.
When I got on Letterboxd, it was already a thing for like 10 years. And I'd already heard about it from a bunch of people. I felt like I was late to the party on Letterboxd.
What?
Yeah, it's been around since like 2010 or something, or a couple years after that.
Wow.
But So I first saw this 4 years ago. And of course, it's one of the most famous silent films ever made. And you can't, the image of Rene Falconetti in this movie is so synonymous with just film, with cinema. It's, you've seen that before, right?
Yeah.
But I was so blown away. I did see it, like I said, with the other score. I was really blown away by this movie. And I was like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's a masterpiece. I get everything that everyone ever said about this movie. Turns out that it's right. Like, it's a great movie.
That's what I was going to say. This movie is exactly what you think it's going to be, but not in a bad way. No, like, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
In the best way. Yeah. What's wrong with someone saying this movie's amazing and then watching it and you're like, yep, it's amazing.
It's
like,
a great feeling, because a lot of movies sometimes that you do hear a lot about, you come around to them and you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
But to see one that's so revered and you watch it and you're just like, yeah, wow.
you know,
like, that's what it did for me.
Yeah.
So seeing it again, I watched it again today with the Voices of Light score, which again, I didn't like quite as much. But yeah, movie is amazing. Like, holy shit. And it's the kind of thing, like, I like Dreyer. It's funny because he did a movie a couple years after this called Vampire. We did it for the film club. No one really loved Vampire. It's one of those kind of early sound movies, so it's kind of sluggish and it's kind of awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because this movie came out before and it's so quick and it's so, like, tight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost hard to believe that the same guy did Vampire, which, again, I don't hate. I think it's an interesting film, but this is just on another, this is, like, on another level.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit.
Yeah.
So what about you?
Yeah, I mean, this is, like you said, it's one of those that I hadn't seen before, but you hear so much about it. Everyone talks about it every chance they get. And for me, it's like Vive Sa Vie, right? Like, that was my, like, when I saw Vive Sa Vie, I was like, wow, like, what is she watching? And she's crying. And, you know, people go to the movies so much in new wave movies. That's, like, one of the factors. That's what makes a new wave movie, right? It's mm-hmm. someone going to the movies and being affected. And it popularized that in movies. So it already meant so much to me because of what it means to her in Vive Sa Vie. And I always, like, when I see that scene, when I see her crying, like, that makes me cry. And she's crying because she's crying on screen because Joan of Arc is crying. So I've been in this cycle of tears that I didn't know the source, but now I do. And of course it's wonderful. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And, like, okay, last week we did Un Chien Andalou, right? That was made, like, what?
It came out a year after
this. I know that it's a small, low-budget movie, a short movie, but holy shit, like, I can't believe that these movies are only a year apart. I really can't. This movie is so timeless. It's timeless. I truly think it's timeless.
It's so timeless that... No, and we'll talk about this in a little bit because you did just watch the Bresson one.
Oh, yeah.
This is so timeless that when you're watching this now in 2022, you're like, yep, this is still the definitive, like, Joan of Arc movie.
Yes, yes. So, do you want me to talk about a little bit about the different versions of the Joan of Arc story?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, so we have an Ingrid Bergman version directed by Victor Fleming. It was actually his last movie. Came out in 1948. Wow. These are, like, the big Joan of Arcs.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that. And then... there's a Gene Seberg one called Saint Joan. Have you heard of this?
No.
Released in 1957, directed by Otto Preminger, who's a great director, wow. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But and I watched a clip. I thought, like, every time I hear about this one, and people bashed it a lot, and they're like, Gene Seberg shouldn't have been playing Joan of Arc. So people bashed it a lot, and then I was like, you know what? I'm gonna watch a clip from this movie. I hate to break it to you guys, she's not bad in it. She's actually really good. It's kind of silly because, like,
you heard it here first.
She's speaking English and she's, like, literally supposed to be French against the English. So that was a little weird. And I'm sure the movie's not great. But from what I saw, a short little clip of her at the trial, not bad.
You know what? Just as a little asterisk here, and I hate to, like, break up this flow, but what you just said about that, I completely agree with. Did you see Chernobyl on HBO?
Yeah.
The miniseries?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
I loved it, but I remember the first episode took me a second to get used. They're all speaking English.
Yeah, that always annoys me.
And it really, that I got really pissed off. Me. And I almost turned it off. I'm so glad I didn't. Because
no, that's one of my
of
big
the best
triggers
things on
too.
TV I've seen in the last, like, decade.
But, I agree. I really like
it. But yeah, it's one of those things where, like, it's just so catered for I mean, it's an American production.
It's an American production, yes. But yeah. The Love of My Life, Anton Walbrook is in it.
No, the yeah. Preminger one?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I think he's one of the judges.
was the first thing you saw him in Colonel Blimp?
Yes. And ever since then, it's been a love affair. Ever since, yeah. He's so, love him.
He's a dreamboat.
It's totally. Anyway, so then our friend Robert Bresson, in 1962, made The Trial of Joan of Arc because he didn't like Dreyer's version. And what he said about it was, "For want of truth, the public gets hooked on the false. Falconetti's way of casting her eyes to heaven in Dreyer's film used to make people weep." He this was just a note he wrote. He wrote, used to make people weep. Basically, this is his whole thing, right? He didn't like actors. He didn't like photographed theater, as he called it. So I wanted to watch his version because I really like him, and like I have this love-hate relationship with him, and I was kind of telling you this before. I think his theory is great, and but I think it only works for him. I think he was the only one that could ever use that and make it work. So I watched his version today, which is why I'm like so depressed, because I've been watching really sad movies. Two Joan of Arcs.
You seemed your usual bubbly self. I couldn't even tell.
Yeah. Anyway, so I watched it today, and it's good. Like, it's a good movie. It's only an hour long. I highly recommend it.
Oh, it's shorter than this one.
Shorter than this one.
Wow.
And what's really interesting about it is that, so his whole thing is that his models, not actors, models, you know, don't show expression, right? And they don't, you know, as Falconetti did, cast their eyes to heaven and be dramatic. And so, but what's great about it is it opens with, she's in a trial and, you know, he loves hands. So it's very much about like her hands, like on the Bible, shackled, and then her like feet and stuff. And it starts in court. And she's so calm and collected and a regular Bresson model, right? Not showing any expression. And then the second she gets back in her room and they take off all her chains, she starts crying. And I was floored. I was like, emotion this early in a Bresson movie? Like, crazy.
It's Christmas.
But it worked so well. And I thought that was very cool. Anyway.
Huh.
But this movie's better.
Right, right. But that movie has its own like DNA, right? Like, there's no even really... The way that
completely
it's...
Completely different. Yeah, completely. Yeah. But a lot of the dialogue is the same because, again, Bresson opens the same way this movie opens by saying, we took the original transcript from...
That's kind of cheap.
Yeah, right?
You son of a bitch.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Actually, this movie opens, this Bresson one, it's really interesting, with a figure. You don't know who it is. You just follow them from the back. And then it turns out that it's her mother. And it's a little similar to... I think Mouchette opens like this too. It's Joan of Arc's mother appearing in front of a court saying like, oh, my daughter was always a really nice girl and she was chosen by God, but they burned her. And then like, it starts like Joan of Arc. Like, it doesn't, I don't even think she says like her name is Joan. I think it's, you know what it is? It's like a little after Joan of Arc was killed, they had this like clearing of her name basically. And I think that's what he shows you to start
with. It was
like 20
years later.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was cool. Like, he does cool things like that. That's the thing. And then.
That's cool. But the whole, I feel like Bresson's, and I'm a Bresson fan. I haven't seen as many as I should have, but the ones I've seen, I've really liked. And I really like his theory on stuff. But I feel like his intention with his Joan of Arc, having not seen it, but from what you just said, it's almost like he's trying to replace.
Yes, which
one.
Is wrong.
Like,
because
hey,
this
here's
a
how
masterpiece.
You do it.
Yeah.
That's kind of insidious to me. And that kind
I
of
think so
me off.
Too. I agree. I agree. Totally.
Was Dreyer still alive when that one came out? I think
I don't know when he died. It came out in 1962.
Oh, he died in 1968.
So he was alive. That's fucked up.
Yeah,
that is.
Fucked up.
That is.
It would have been fucked up if he waited till he did it after he died, too.
Really? I think it would have been a little kinder.
I don't know. But yeah, it's still...
Especially in Salt in the Wound is that there was no definitive version. Like, Dreyer's was lost when he made it.
Oh, God.
So that's fucked up, too.
That is fucked up.
Damn it.
I'm sure they did not... They were not pals, right?
Yeah. But anyway, like, what do we talk about first?
Let's
I mean, we've already talked about
what?
A lot, but like, this is such a good movie and there's so much to talk about.
Here's where we start. It's one word. Are you ready?
Falconetti.
Falconetti.
Hell yeah. That was the first thing I wrote here.
So she was a theater actress.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was only her second film.
And last.
Her last.
Mm-hmm.
And after this, she kind of went back to the stage and she did like light musical theater.
She produced comedies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like she produced them.
Yeah. So
and
this
starred
is,
in them.
Yeah. This wasn't really her like thing.
And she was always confused in her life. Like, I don't get why people love me in that movie so much. Like, she's, I don't know. She seems like such an interesting woman, and it's really tragic. I mean, you know what happened to her, right?
Yes.
So she suffered from mental illness all her life, and then she fled France during World War II.
To
she
like
ended
Buenos
up in
Aires, yeah.
She ended up in Argentina, and mm-hmm. she like killed herself in 1946. I want to say I didn't write it down, but she was 54 years old.
I heard that she killed
so
herself
sad.
Of like malnutrition or
yeah,
something.
Yeah,
yeah, which is really, really sad.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you watch her in this movie and it's like, and here's, this was also an initial thought of mine. It's just the first time you see her, like, her giant eyes just open, like, she looks possessed almost.
Yeah.
But in, like, a beautiful way. Like, and it's when she goes, like, when they ask her, and this is when it really caught me, they ask her, like, oh, what is the gift that you're gonna get? And she goes, the salvation of my soul. And she, her eyes like get big and she like looks up and I'm like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, and then he spits on her face. Like,
yeah. I mean, look, this is not like a hot take, but she has one of the most expressive faces in all of cinema. Like, this
I think
is
so too.
And this is a key. And again, I know everyone thinks this, but her performance in this is truly like one of the absolute great
yes.
screen performances ever committed to cellular.
Yes.
Like, people will talk, you know, no, this is like top three screen performances. Don't you think?
I think. And also, I think you're sounding a little bit like our friend.
Which friend?
Pauline Kael.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get into that.
That's not a bad thing.
No, I know, because you literally said, because I try to avoid it. I try not to read Pauline's reviews uh-huh. before you read them to me, but it was there on Wikipedia, and she straight up said that, so
yeah.
I couldn't, like, it was right there.
Yeah.
But, yes, I think that she's brilliant, and I think that she creates a whole class of her own with this movie, because it's like expressionistic acting, right? But
yeah.
It's never, I mean, I could see someone watching it and saying like, oh, that's weird. But also, I can't see someone watching it and say that's bad. Does that make
no.
sense?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Like, who would think this is bad? It's crazy too, because they didn't have, Dreyer's whole thing was they couldn't have makeup on.
Mm-hmm.
So her and all the other actors, yeah. and which is why a lot of the other actors are shot kind of like grotesquely. They're mm-hmm. shot from like low angles with like harsh light
oh,
to make them look grotesque.
Just yeah.
But yeah, they none of them have makeup on, and this is a movie comprised entirely of faces.
Yes.
Like
yes.
You know how John Cassavetes has the movie called Faces?
Mm-hmm.
Bullshit. This is Faces.
Yes. Yes.
I say that with all love to Cassavetes.
Yes.
Obviously. This is truly, and it's crazy because they spent so much money on the sets for this movie,
uh-huh.
but you cannot tell.
Yeah, no.
Because it's all close-ups, which
yeah.
I love
yeah.
about this movie.
Me too.
And while I was watching it, I was like, what a smart way to get around production detail. Because you don't have to show all these like period details.
And yet it was so expensive.
And when the movie was done, his producer's like, hey, what the fuck? Like, we spent all this money. I think it was like the most expensive movie
Something
sets
like,
at the time.
Yes, yes.
And they were angry. And then
yeah.
and then Dreyer was like, hey, but it affected their performances. So what are you going to do?
Yeah,
yeah. Because he's a mafioso. What are you going to do?
Well, to go back to Bresson, you said he's doing faces, right? Well, Bresson's all about hands. And
yeah.
like Bresson's thing, and this is the last thing
they couldn't
say.
Be more different.
I don't want to talk too much about him, but like his thing was, okay, Falconetti, she is doing this expressionistic acting. First of all, he doesn't even like acting, let alone expressionistic acting. So he really didn't like
that. And I get
that,
and that's valid.
Yes, yes. But his whole thing was like, okay, Dreyer victimizes Joan of Arc. This is a movie about Joan of Arc being martyred and her being a victim and her being like crying constantly.
Yeah.
And so in his movie, it is very much the opposite. Like she's like kind of a firecracker, but not too dramatic. Like she just kind of does her thing. And then, like I said, she only cries when she's in private.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's such a different vibe. It's such a different take on it, you know? And I get people saying she is such a victim in this movie and she is such a like, yeah, just victimized. But also It's called The Passion of Joan of Arc. Like, it's literally trying to mirror, like, the crucifixion, essentially. And it's,
essentially, yeah.
Yeah, so you can't not have that.
I think...
It's different. It's just different.
She's appropriately... Falconetti is appropriately dramatic in this movie. And I think... First of all, I could see the victim angle, but she is also very stoic throughout this movie.
Mm-hmm. The moments that get me the most is when she kind of just, like... She just kind of, like, looks like... and she, but she's not crying. She's not smiling. She's not frowning. She's just kind of looking stoic and shocked, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are... Yeah.
Those are some of the best moments.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, she's... Look, it's two different styles of acting, really. And, like, I get both ways. Both ways are valid. Like you said, Bresson's only works for a Bresson movie, though.
Yes. Yes.
but yeah, I mean, so do you know... Have you heard anything about the potentially abusive relationship between her and Dreyer?
I did. But then I also read some stuff that it was just rumors.
That's what I saw, too. So the reports are that he was a shithead to her during the making of this movie, that he was beyond demanding. He was kind of physically abusive. There's this quote from Roger Ebert who said, "For Falconetti, the performance was an ordeal. Legends from the set tell of Dreyer forcing her to kneel painfully on stones and then wipe all expression from her face so that the viewer would read suppressed inner pain. He filmed the same shots again and again, hoping that in the editing room he could find exactly the right nuance in her facial expressions."
Well, we know he did a lot of takes because he was literally able to create that negative, second negative.
He's like Kubrick Sr., you know?
Yeah, but hopefully not. I don't know.
Hopefully not.
Legends, I mean, come on.
But yeah, then there's accounts that wasn't necessarily the case. But also it's a little suspicious that this was Renee Falconetti's last film.
That's true.
It's like,
but she always said she just never cared for cinema and she never cared for
it. I get that. But maybe there's some truth to
Dreyer
being a shithead.
Sis shaved her head on screen.
She did.
And I listened to this thing about her daughter because her daughter's like one of her biographers. There's this recorded interview on Criterion and her daughter was talking about how she tried to get around like shaving her head, but... Listen, she ended up doing it. If you don't care about cinema that much and you don't care about being in movies and she didn't take this too seriously, she wouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Like Clara Bow wouldn't have done it. Louise Brooks.
Yeah. Oh, you heard how there was like rumors that Lillian Gish was going to do it and the French nationalists just said absolutely not.
Yeah.
Which is, I kind of love. Yeah. Like, So, yeah, I mean, do you want to talk about the cinematography a little bit?
Yes.
Rudolf Maté is the cinematographer. And genius. I just think that, yes, I just think that everything here is working to make you feel trapped, desperate, helpless, and just plain old sad.
Claustrophobic.
And it just works so well all the time. Constant. I tried to compile a list and it's so fucking long. Like, I can't even read every example because it's so long because there's so many beautiful shots that do exactly what they're supposed to do. Like, that's the best way to describe it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of, like, what Greg Tolan did on Citizen Kane, right? Like, because they also, for this movie, to get all these, like, low-angle shots, they dug holes in the ground and put the camera in there and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think from a modern standpoint, it's just so riveting because of the photography and because of the editing, and it's quick. It's quick. This is not a slow movie.
Oh my God, yeah.
For a movie that does consist of just this like trial mostly and then the burning at stake, it's a very engaging, quick moving movie.
There's so much movement. There is.
And it's just, again, like I said, it's a film of faces. And it's like you get all this great stuff. There's like, you know, you see the flies are in shots. Like flies
are
in people's
faces. Yes,
fly on her
face at one point.
This is the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Of course there's going to be flies. It's just like nice touches like that, you know?
How about all those pans? Like those pans just show the hierarchy of like all the people she's up against, right?
Yeah.
And it works so well. They go for so long. There's one where they're playing telephone, basically. They're whispering all the clergymen.
Oh, yeah.
Goes for so long and you're like... Fuck, like there's all of these people against her.
Mm-hmm.
And he repeats it and he does it. And every single time, every single one of those pans, like they're getting that letter ready or something, those altar boys, like it's always just this group of people that she's up against.
What do you think about the priest?
Which one?
Like the main one.
The evil one?
The one that wants her to...
The one that's trying to help her, but really deceiving her?
Yeah, yeah.
He was okay. I think in the end he actually cries. Like he feels bad in the end.
He reminds me of someone.
Yeah, you're right. Some old butler in something.
Yeah.
Some Chives.
Who does he look like? Wait, it's Jeeves. It's Jeeves.
Clearly, I'm depressed and hungry.
You mean you didn't have a butler growing up?
Chives.
Yeah, it's Jeeves. We're don't you remember? That. Do you remember Ask Jeeves? It was before like Google.
What?
It was a search engine. Ask Jeeves.
I don't remember. But
yeah, who does he look like?
Some butler somewhere.
Yeah, you reminded me of someone.
You know another one? I'm sorry, I'm still talking about like shots and the way they evoke emotions.
How dare you?
But when she wakes up, first of all, blood being pulled from her arm.
Oh, yeah.
That was real. It wasn't her arm, but it was an extra. That's real.
Oh, shit. Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Because
I assumed it was fake.
I watched this thing about like the two negatives side by side, and they're like, here you can see the difference because the extra's blood in this one shoots out, and in this one it just gushes down.
Oh, like, and I was like, God.
Yeah. Anyway.
Holy shit.
Right?
Holy shit.
Right. I know.
I thought it was a fake arm.
Me too. They said, it's not Falconetti's arm. It's an extra's arm.
It's
but
fucked up.
Yeah.
So they were getting paid less than her.
Yeah. But I love how when she wakes up after, there's like this shot of her, and her face is cut off. It's only half of her face and the bed frame, her headboard. Do you know what I'm talking about? And it's
absolutely.
Just confusion. Like,
yes.
It's her waking up confused and it's like half her face and it's such a close-up shot. It's just, it's things
just
like that. Yes, yeah. It's things like that I think make this movie so cool.
Yeah.
In a word.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Oh. The watching her hair get swept up in the dustpan. What? And then the crown. First of all, where did that crown come from?
I think...
She was making it out of something.
Yeah,
I don't know what.
Like rope or something. It's like...
Crazy.
Iconic image.
Yes. And then what else? Oh, when they go... Oh, when she says... They ask her about... the judges... Another pan I really love. The judges say like, oh, let's put it to a vote. Like, you know, and then they all raise their hands. Do you know what I'm talking about? And
yep.
It's like this sea of hands.
Yeah.
It's just great. And then what about the torture sequence? It's so abstract. It's really like there's no torture.
No
torture goes on. She just walks in, sees the like really kind of like corny instruments of torture.
Corny.
I mean, there's like saws that are, you know, like wiggly saws that are just hanging.
What about the big...
The wheel, yes.
The wheel.
But it's very abstract.
It is, yeah.
It's really
the guy's
cool.
Just like cranking it.
Yeah. Like, what was the plan? Do you go under there and just.
Yeah, I was wondering how exactly that works. Yeah. They like push you up to it or
but
something.
Then she like sees her after she's fainted, she like sees her feet like going on it. It's.
Yeah.
Like, for example.
Did you know that the. Sorry to cut you off.
No.
Did you know that the whole set, like everything was built in its own. Like, the space made sense. So, like. This wasn't like a collection of sets. It was all like you could go from one room and walk down the hall and be out in the courtyard. Then there was like houses like in the side that you don't even really see in the movie.
Yeah.
But it all made sense like as a space. It was like a practical space.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And I think it was shot like in order, right?
Yep. He shot it from in chronological order.
Yeah.
Hey, what were you going to say?
What was I going to say? No, just like a general, another shot. But I feel really dumb, like, describing shots on a podcast because it is an audio medium.
Well, I guess our hope is that our listeners have freshly viewed the film.
That's what I'm hoping. I hope you guys, watch the movie and then listen to the podcast so it's fresh in your mind. But
if not, obviously, that's fine. But yeah, maybe we should describe stuff in more detail. I don't know. So,
okay.
Jackie,
one
theme of this movie I noticed is that you gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd.
You're so annoying. This is why I don't like Letterboxd. Oh my God.
Just kidding.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Do your worst. Yes, I gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd.
No, that's still good. I'm just like, this was an instant 5-star for me when I saw it.
I'm going to change it to 4.5. No, I'm serious. Because here's what... I impulse do it.
Uh-huh.
So it's like as soon as the movie's done. And there's different movies. Like, I've said this before on the podcast. A lot of the times after I watch the movie and then I do my research and I really sit down and write about it, I realize, holy shit, like, this movie is incredible. And I don't think that's weird.
No.
I'm changing it.
Wow.
As we speak.
Wow.
Should I do 5?
If you have to think about it, then don't do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. This movie is like, I don't know.
Do you know what Dreyer said about it?
No.
He said, in quotes, "I wanted to interpret a hymn to the triumph of the soul over life."
There you go.
That's the movie.
That's the movie. And it's also...
That's going to be it for Seen and Heard, folks, this week. Have a good
one. I mean, it's organized religion versus God, right?
Yes.
And I think that is really important.
Well, like, again, I think it's one of those... We've had so many movies and stories are sort of around the same theme of the dangers of organized religion and what it can do and how people can do terrible things under the name of this umbrella.
Yes. And this whole thing is just like hypocrisy. Like, they're Pharisees, right? And she's Jesus, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's mirroring the crucifixion. And it's like, what a great way to do it, right? And it's like, obviously this happened, right? He didn't make this up, but the way that it's called the Passion of Joan of Arc, and she has the crown, and they're literally testing her like they tested Jesus, you know? They're asking her questions and stuff. Like, it's just the way he did it, and it's about hypocrisy, and it's about this, And they ask her such stupid questions, like, what was St. Michael wearing? His wings. And it's like small-minded questions about stupid things, and you can see it on her face. She's just like, it doesn't fucking matter. It doesn't matter that I dress like a man. Wake up. Like, you know?
Yeah. That's their whole thing. They won't let her go to mass. They're like, okay, you can go to mass if you put on women's clothes.
Yeah, and horrible. Like, no. They're so horrible. How about when... Yes, that is what I'm thinking, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, oh my God, one of the most heartbreaking shots. These are supposed to be priests that are trying to help her. She literally reaches out to one of the judges when she's on the bed, right? And she thinks she's going to die. And she's asking to be buried on holy ground. She reaches out to him. Do you know what I'm talking about? And he literally
pulls back.
Yep. And then he goes, "We're just trying to help you, Joan." It's like, no, you're fucking not.
Yep.
That part made me cry.
You know, I do agree with the people that maybe think that, I mean, this movie is kind of black and white in a sense, right? In the sense that everyone but Joan is drawn very obviously as these kind of grotesque figures. And I get that. But also, you know, this is 1928 we're talking here.
Well, the Jives character, like, kind of cries at the end. Like, the one that was kind of playing her in the start. When he watches her take communion, he starts crying.
Wait, Jives.
The one that looks like a butler.
Jeeves. Yes. You should have a sitcom just called Jives. Your whole sitcom should be a butler who applies to be a butler with the name of Jives, and his whole thing is like, isn't your name supposed to be Jeeves? He's like, no, it's Jives. That's his whole thing.
Anyway. Yes. So I don't think they're very black and white. And even the one at the end who asks her, I think he's kind of sympathetic toward her. He goes, like, how can you still believe that you were sent by God? But I don't think he's saying it in a bad way. I think he's actually genuinely curious.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and here's what else it's about. It's about like, not what else. This all has to do with it. But I love the idea of like, okay, communion is community, right? And it's about like coming together. That's what communion is. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she chooses, like, actually, no, I'm not gonna get communion because I'm gonna listen to like what actually happened between me and God, you know? And I just thought it was like so cool. It's like being alone, and like spirituality is the most subjective thing on earth, and it only, like, intolerance is born when you think spirituality should be an objective thing. D.W. Griffith could never understand this movie, make this movie. Anyway, so I just love that it's about being alone and having the relationship with whatever God you believe in, like, alone, you know? And I think that is really beautiful.
Yeah,
Because that's when it gets evil, is when you want to, like, homogenize people and have them all believe the same thing and follow the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, I love when they ask her, they're like, did God promise you anything? And she looks at them and she goes, that has nothing to do with this trial.
Yeah.
No, it really is. I think she even says it at one point, like, yes, to be alone with God. And then at the end she says, like, they say, oh, what about, he asks her, he's like, how do you still think you were sent by God? Like, what's going to be your deliverance or something? And she goes, oh, like the salvation of my soul. And he goes, what about your freedom? And she goes, death. like to get away from you fuckers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. And then you could also, I feel like, yes, this is a very religious, spiritual movie. And then I feel like there's a whole other thing where if you actually don't want to look at it that way, you can look at it about like martyrdom and like what it means to like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's. Yeah.
I mean, she's like the ultimate martyr.
It's just basically standing up for like what you believe in. Mm-hmm. And it's.
You know what I do really like about this movie is the fact that unlike like the big Silent Napoleon epic by Abel Gance, this is like, it's literally just the trial and her death. Like I like the structure of this movie, and I like that he just decided to focus on this like the last days.
Yes, which is also weird that Bresson did the same exact thing.
Yeah, it's kind of
like
a fuck
it
you.
Is kind of yes. Yeah. Anyway.
But anyway, yeah, let's do Sight and Sound. You want to do that?
Yes, let's do it.
What about you? What was your favorite sight?
Okay. This is really hard because everything I mentioned throughout the podcast were honorable mentions / ties because there are so many great ones.
Yeah.
But I think it's gotta be like at the end when she's just received communion and she's like praying.
The cross is behind her.
Cross is behind her, but it's when she's smiling. It's not when she's like crying and very serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's yours?
It's beautiful. Here's the thing. There's not one specific
exactly,
image
it's
in
hard.
This.
Hard, yeah.
For my side, I just said Falconetti's face. That applies to the whole film.
Yeah, it does.
I can't even begin to pick a single image. The one you picked is great with the cross behind her. And if I had to pick a single one, that would be it.
And it's not even a real cross. It's just the window.
It's the window. Yeah. It's the bars on the window that forms a cross. Because it even cuts it off at the top to make it look like a crucifix instead of just like an X.
Yeah.
But yeah, just Falconetti's face. I mean, come on. This is one of the all-time iconic faces in film.
Yeah.
Probably the number one.
Yeah.
Let's just say number one.
Let's do it.
Whose face is more iconic than hers in a film? Nobody.
Anton Walbrook in Colonel Blimp.
Okay. So maybe she's number two. What about sound? What did you do for sound?
Okay, so my favorite sound is when she sees her crown in the dustpan with her hair, the violins start, and that's when she like says like, I changed my mind, like I want to take back my confession.
Okay, let's hear it. This is from the Voices of Light accompaniment.
Those violins are crazy.
Well, you have to stop it.
Those violins are crazy.
Wait, say it again.
Those violins are crazy.
One more time. I'm just kidding. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like the Dance Macabre.
Yeah, what's that from?
It's just a piece.
Yeah. Play it for me.
The beginning.
Yeah, I think violins are a great way to build tension.
Yeah.
What's your favorite sound?
Okay, I feel like I'm not being lazy on this, I swear.
Oh my God.
So for the Criterion disc, when you boot up the disc, the first option to watch the movie is silently. And because this movie has no definitive score, I'm just going to say I don't have a favorite sound because...
Oh my God.
I'd feel weird picking any of the... Not that you should... But I'd feel weird picking any of the existing scores because none of them are definitive. And yeah, a lot of people just watch this movie completely silent. I saw that on Letterboxd. A lot of people were pissed off because they watched it completely silent because that is the first option on the Criterion disc.
Funny.
It leads me to believe that is the purest way, the purest expression of this film is completely silent.
I'm trying to think what she does in Vive Sa Vie. Is there music while she's watching it? Yeah, I want
to
say no.
I want to say no, too. I think when that movie came out, the early to mid-60s, I don't think there would have been like a score for this. So here is my favorite sound from The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Oh,
ready?
Oh, no.
There we go.
Beautiful. So what does Pauline say?
Well, let's get the bad news out of the way first.
What? I don't believe you.
I'm just kidding. Is the segment where we dive into Pauline Kael's review of the film. So this is what Pauline Kael had to say. One of the greatest of all movies. The director, Carl Dreyer, based the script on the trial records, and the testimony appears to be given for the first time. As the five grueling cross-examinations follow each other, Dreyer turns the camera on the faces of Joan and the judges, and in giant close-ups, he reveals his interpretation of their emotions. In this enlargement, Joan and her persecutors are shockingly fleshly, isolated with their sweat, warts, spittle, and tears, and, as no one used makeup, with startlingly individual contours, features, and skin. No other film has so subtly linked eroticism with religious persecution. Falconetti's Joan may be the finest performance ever recorded on film.
Wow. When did she write this?
I don't know when she wrote it. I don't have that info. but yeah, I mean, I agree with Pauline.
I agree with Pauline.
I believe it is one of the greatest of all movies. And I do believe that Falconetti's Joan may be the finest performance ever recorded on film.
See, I will never feel comfortable saying something like that. I can name a bunch. I can name some of my favorites, but I don't think I could ever sit and say, that's the one.
You know what it is? It's because it's such a trailblazing performance. Like, have there been performances that have matched this since? Yes. But this was the first. And I can't think of a performance earlier than this.
Yeah, that was this.
That was so great.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So Letterboxd. Shall we?
Yeah. So, very hard to find low ratings for this movie. I would just like to say that. 4.5 stars. God, parentheses, literally, damn. Literally's in parentheses.
Someone gave it a star and said, someone should do a Kuleshov experiment where they juxtapose Falconetti's face with images of Ex-Lax and blocks of cheese. What a boring, empty movie.
What?
All the vacuousness of transcendental cinema with the most annoying trappings of a Catholic mass. And her face is so stupid and blank the whole time. The judges are literally deliberately made ugly and fat with bright lights showing their blemishes because, you know, they're the bad guys. LOL. Oh, no. I really can't stand this movie.
Wow.
Yeah, Jesus.
Someone gave it 1 star, wrote a bunch about how they could praise the movie, and then wrote, but bitch, this ain't 2019. I'm mentally and physically exhausted, and I'm over trying to intellectualize my taste just because some internet algorithm says I should measure my hobby against some list. Because when you're bored, you're bored.
Star and a half. Watched at 8 a.m. with a ham and cheese grilled sandwich.
That's it?
Yep.
Someone just wrote, fuck, man.
This person gave it 1.5 stars and said, while technically sound for a 1920s film, it's poorly paced with an uninteresting storyline, mostly due to a lack of knowledge about our protagonist that the film makes no attempt at fixing, making me not care at all about what is going on.
What?
So clearly this person has no knowledge of who Joan of Arc even was. So,
and it's like, would it kill you to look her up on Wiki? Like, that's what I did, because honestly, I didn't really understand the whole, I didn't know that there were, the Burgundy French people who were allies with the British. I didn't get that, because I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I just looked it up. It wasn't that hard.
Yeah, I had a basic understanding of who she was, and then I went online and filled that out.
Yeah.
Which this person should do, too, because a movie can't always, feed you everything on the spoon, you gotta do your own work sometimes.
Yeah.
I think expecting you to know who a very important historical figure is not too much of a risk.
I agree. Someone gave it 4 stars and wrote, me at the gender clinic.
2 stars. There were some pretty shots, but it didn't capture me, especially since I am not religious. Too much God talk. Such big, beautiful eyes, though. Too much God talk.
Such big, beautiful eyes. So someone gave it 3 stars, but wrote, well, now I know what not to watch.
Cool.
Okay, 1 star. 3/4 of the movie was just a close-up of Joan looking petrified. Like, .. Can they give us something else?
Oh, God, this one's bad. 2 stars. Had it been done now, it would have been seen as a third-rate B-movie. The pathos, the consistent close-ups of someone who, in all honesty, seems like the village idiot throughout the movie, doesn't justify its canon place in film history.
What? Village idiot?
They used
perhaps
the words,
you, madam,
village idiot.
Are the village idiot. And that was a phantom quote. 4.5 stars. Girl boss gets gaslighted. A tale as old as time. yeah.
People so, having a field day on this one.
I know. I can definitely proudly say that I have bumped my Letterboxd review after doing all of this.
That's
thinking
great.
And
half
meditating.
A star.
It's a big deal.
No, it
four
is.
And a half
four...
stars is like...
No, believe me, it is.
This is a beautiful movie. And like I mentioned before, this movie is why we love movies. Because
yes.
You're in someone's face.
Yes. Agreed.
And that's it.
This is a movie lover's movie.
I think you're right.
Do you agree? I said this last week too. Someone who maybe hasn't seen silent film before.
This is
like
a good starter.
It's a good one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah.
Like,
I think so.
They don't get much more modern than this,
mm-mm,
I think.
Mm-mm.
So. Well.
Next week, we're so excited.
No more silence.
I'm glad we went out with a bang, because this is definitely the best one from the ones we've watched.
Yes, I agree.
Come on. Yep. I think this is like, yes. Yep. But next week, we're very excited because it's our first Bergman movie.
Bergman.
Bergman is like... definitely top 5 favorite directors.
Yes. I have a big poster hanging in my living room.
You do indeed. And it's Seventh Seal,
it
which
is
a great
Seal.
Movie, iconic movie.
Yeah, listen, this isn't a homework movie. It kind of has a reputation. You're like, oh, death. They're playing chess with death and it's the Middle Ages and there's a plague. Guess what? This is an entertaining, like, great mm-hmm. film. Like, mm-hmm. it's not this, like, unreachable thing.
No.
It's like very down
very
to earth.
Accessible.
Very accessible. That's the misconception with Bergman, is that he's inaccessible. He's very accessible.
I don't think he's inaccessible.
He goes out of his way to entertain you, make you laugh. There's humor in The Seventh Seal.
Oh yeah.
So that's what we're doing next week.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Probably the greatest silent film on the Sight and Sound list.
You know what? Trying to think of another silent movie. We watched all of them in the past 5 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've already said. I'm repeating myself. Join us next week for Seventh Seal.
Yep. It'll be fun.
I said that like such a giddy little
No, it's cute
Seal.
Though. It's cute. It's cute. It adds something.
All right.
Bye. Seen and Heard is presented by the Arroyo Film Club, produced by and starring Greg Kleinschmidt and Jacqueline Pistachia, edited by Greg Kleinschmidt, music by Andrew Cox. Special thanks to Catherine Ferenczak.